Welcome to the Britpop Show, everybody. And this week we have somebody who has the dubious honour of being the first person ever to return to the Britpop Show, other than me, of course. Returning to the scene of the crime, we have Jane Savage, co-owner of PR agency Savage and Best. And back in the day, back in the 90s, she represented Suede, Pulp, Verve, Elastica, Long Pigs, Marion, Menswear, Ultrasound, Echo Belly and Cooler Shaker. Can you believe that list? She's also author of Lunch with the Wild Frontiers and Here They Come With Their Makeup On, which is a song about Suede and in particular their best album, coming up. Filmstar by Suede, and we have on the line with us Jane Savage this week. And Jane, I was just explaining to everybody that you have the dubious honour of being the first person to return to the Britpop Show, other than, of course, me. And explain to them all of the bands that you represented back in the 90s. You represented Suede, Pulp, Verve, Elastica, Long Pigs, Marion, Menswear, Ultrasound, Echo Belly and Cooler Shaker. Have I missed any? Well, we seem to be having a slight issue here. What I'll do is I'll play the next song and we'll try and get Jane back on the line.
One time they were just like you. Drinking, smoking, sex and sniffing glue. Help the aged. Don't just put them in a home. Can't have much fun when they're all on their own. Give a hand if you can. Try to help.
them to unwind. Give them hope and give them comfort. Cast the running out of time. In the meantime, we try to forget that nothing lasts forever. No big deal, so give us all a feel. Falling down or falls away. When did you first realize? Oh, it's time you're choking.
The aged DJ here, Jane. Can you hear us? We are having some technicalities here. We're going to go straight into Creep by Radiohead. If we can't fix this, we may have to come up with an alternative plan. Here's Creep by Radiohead.
Hits from the 1990s. You're so very special.
I believe we may have fixed the problem. Jane, are you on the line?
Yes, I'm here on the line.
Oh, that's incredible. Yes, do you know what's happened? I tried to, we've gone Android, we've gone Apple. You have to go Apple nowadays, it seems, just to make anything work. Apologies to everybody listening and including you, Jane, who have been patiently waiting for us to actually launch on this. Now, I was just explaining to everybody that you have the dubious honour of being the first person to return to the show, to the scene of the crime, if you like. And I explained to them all of the bands that you used to be as a PR agent for. You're here to talk about your new book, This Is Hardcore. But before we do that, can I ask you, I'm sure lots of people want to know the answer to this question. What is a PR agency? How does it work?
Gosh, I don't know if I've been asked that question recently. I know it's completely changed from what it was in the olden days. I used to describe my job as being a music taste evangelist, which was meaning that I used to find my favorite music and then tell my friends about it, and all those friends happened to write for The Enemy and Melody Maker, and then, you know, and all those magazines that were around in the 90s, who eventually went on to write for broadsheets. So that's what it was in the old days. And I think also there's this special balance you have to maintain between representing the best interests of the band and also staying sort of in line with journalists as well. You can't make journalists angry, and you can't upset the bands you're representing. So I think there's a delicate balance. But generally, it's respecting the interests of your band and representing them to the best of your ability. I think that's what PR used to be. Now, I think it might be a bit about ticking boxes, and it's almost become an arm of marketing. It's a job that's completely changed over the years, which I think is a bit sad, but there you go.
And so acting for rock stars must have been a bit easier than acting for, say, politicians, because for a rock star, you just say, yeah, they did it all and more. You know, I guess you could say anything to get on the front cover. Is that right, or how does that work?
I don't know. I think before the internet, which is very interesting about the Britpop, was the last musical movements in the UK, possibly, I mean, I hesitate to say the world, but certainly, you know, the 90s was just before the internet, and you could make stories up and they couldn't be checked. And also which is fun actually, but you could also, about, you know, a magazine would write about a band. There was no way of finding out what they sounded like until you went to check them out live. So often you went to a gig just to see if they're as good as what The Enemy had said. And there was lots of people there at the back of the crowd with their arms folded, just saying, figuratively, impress me. I think that was quite interesting, rather than just checking out all online. I think that was what was interesting about the 90s.
So what was the most outrageous story that you ever made up?
okay, not outrageous, but I suppose the kind of things I used to do. I used to think of the perfect, because I actually used to get paid £50 a week for doing gossip for The Shaman. Now, that's not on my CV, but that would involve me, for instance, writing a gossip story masquerading as a news story, saying that the Shaman had come from Manchester in their van to play a gig in London. They were carrying 500 copies of their new 12-inch single, but unfortunately, there was a bit of a prang on the M1, and all the copies had fallen out on the motorway and been destroyed. So if you find one in a shop, it's probably going to be quite rare. You should probably snap it up. Now, I used to say, no one gets hurt in that story, but it's kind of one of those sort of like imaginative stories where, you know, you get the name of the Shaman in the gossip columns, for instance, and that from the gossip column, you'd graduate to a proper news story, and then, you know, and then a small feature. And it's just one of the ways of getting sort of a rung on the ladder.
And did it work? Did it work? Yeah, they sold a lot.
Yeah, all those stories used to end up in the papers. I also used to have another band called 25th of May around, and they were kind of, when I used to describe them as being so left-wing, they were almost comically left-wing. And so we used to say there were riots at all their gigs, and we used to put the journalists in touch with promoters to say that, yes, there was a riot here last night, and that was not a promoter. It was a friend of the band with an appropriate regional accent sort of saying, yes, they were here, and lots of trouble ensued. And that just ended up in, you know, in various sort of stories in the music papers. And of course, now you would just check that by Googling and find out there was no one at the gig at all. There was no riot. End of story. But it was kind of fun and harmless. And it was one of the ways we used to try and get bands that we really believed in the papers in those days.
And you've got, you know, the list of clients that you have are very impressive, particularly looking back now on that era. It's just basically everyone who was anyone seemed to come to you. Who came first? Who was the first big band that came to you?
Okay, this is a bad line now. Did you say how did they first come to me?
Yeah, who was the first big band that came to you?
Gosh, well, I think before I started Savage and Best, I've been working with lots of big artists. I did Roy Orbison's press in the late 80s, but then I started a really sort of a very small independent label and did a band called Green on Red from America and Gay Bikers on Acid. And I kind of, that was when I realised that how movements were very important. So, for instance, if I aligned Gay Bikers on Acid to the Grebo scene, they got twice as much press. And if I said that Green on Red were in the New American Invasion with Long Riders and Jason and the Scorchers, you got twice as much press. And I think I kind of knew that when I started to do all the shoegazing bands like Curve and Lush and Moose, that, you know, shoegazing was a good movement to be aligned to. And the same thing happened with all the Britpop bands. Before it was even Britpop, it was called the Camden scene, because they all, hung around our office. But I think we did the Pixies and the Cocteau Twins just before Britpop happened, and that made us have a really good relationship with all the Inkies, as they were called, the NME, Melody Maker and Record Mirror and Sounds. And we started to get a good reputation. So when we actually stumbled across Suede in a small pub in 91, and then The Verve playing to about six people at the Tufnell Park Dome, just a year later, and then obviously Pulp have been going for years and years, we suddenly started following them around. I think the band that started Britpop, that made my company kind of an important player, as it were, was Suede, because we got the front cover of Melody Maker after, you know, before they'd released a single. And then that just exploded and made everybody ring our office, including lots and lots of bands. So I suppose Suede was the first one that was a big band. And we were approached by both Saul Goodman of New Records and Brett, who wrote us a letter. That's how it happened.
And who were the hardest to represent?
The hardest to represent? That's a very good question. I would say, David, they were all so amazing. We loved them all so much that they were easy to represent. I mean, I used to, for instance, a band you might think were quite difficult, like the Auteurs, Luke was a godsend for journalists, because everything he said was controversial. So I always knew we had a great band when they would end up on the cover of Les Inrockuptibles in France, or Les Inrockuptibles, as they say, because we used to get the Auteurs and Pulp and Suede on all their covers, because I think they kind of had a literary bent, and the French loved those bands. So I think they were the easiest to represent. I mean, I found a couple of them, I suppose. I mean, Cooler Shaker weren't the easiest to represent because I thought, you know, occasionally they said a couple of things that were a bit, weren't quite on message, as it were. But generally, it was a very easy thing to do because everybody loved all our bands.
Now, Cooler Shaker, of course, have brought out a new album. Have you heard it?
I haven't heard Cooler Shaker's new album. No, I must do that. I'm sorry.
No, that's no problem. But and of those artists, Suede, Pulp, Echo Belly, Cooler Shaker, they're all still touring. Are you surprised?
I'm not surprised by some of them. I mean, I saw Pulp last year. They're incredible. Pulp are still going to tour this year. Suede, I saw several times in the last couple of years. They're amazing. I'm not remotely surprised that, you know, that they're still doing well. I don't know. I think there's still a market for that kind of music, isn't there, really? I mean, it was a very important time in British music, so I'm not surprised, really, no.
Yeah, I think so. And I think also the people who were so moved by Britpop have probably had their kids now and have now got the money to go out and actually go and see the bands that maybe they didn't see back in the day.
Go on. Sorry.
No, carry on.
I was going to say that if when I do readings and things and people sort of enamoured by all the bands I used to represent, they're often the people that left school at 12 or 13 and therefore... when Suede and Pulp were coming to prominence in the early 90s, and now they're obviously, I don't know what they are, 40 years old, would that make them?
Yeah, 40, yeah. Somewhere between 40 and 50, I would say.
Yeah.
So I'm going to play a bit of Cooler Shaker now, and then after that we're going to move on to Pulp, because that's the main reason we're here. This is Tatva by Cooler Shaker, and then after that, provided the line keeps behaving, we'll move on to Pulp, and then onto your book, which is out this week. This is Tatva by Cooler Shaker.
Okay, great.
I'm
Tattva by Cooler Shaker, and this week we have in the studio with us Jane Savage. And Jane Savage is the co-founder of Savage and Best, the PR agency from the 90s, which frankly, if you were in a band and you weren't on Jane's PR agency, then you basically weren't where you needed to be. Now, Jane is releasing a book on Thursday, in fact, about Pulp's album, This Is Hardcore. And I promised Jane, I promised you that we would move on to Pulp. When did Pulp first come onto your radar?
Okay, so I think that's, Pulp first came onto my radar because I was at university with their original founder member, Peter Dalton, who actually started the band with Jarvis Cocker in 1978. So Dolly, as he was known then, used to talk about this band called Pulp that he was in when I was in university in the mid to late 80s. And I used to say, well, I remember them because he'd done a John Peel session, but other than that, I thought they weren't, you know, up to much or whatever. And then after that, I think when I moved to London, I mean, at some point, Dolly joined a weird Christian cult called the 9 o'clock service in Sheffield. I went up to rescue him once. And it was a very bizarre experience. But when I moved to London, when we started Savage and Best, I heard My Legendary Girlfriend by Pulp, which had become single of the week in the NME. And I thought that they suddenly got really good. So we were presented with OU, the single, which I thought was fantastic. And then we decided, because Mickey from Lush kept saying, you've got to go and see Pulp live, they've become really good. And so I used to go and see Pulp in places like Brighton and notice that Jarvis was the greatest raconteur of his generation. He used to tell these little stories between songs and you never want them to end. He was like a 1970s comedian. It was okay to like, if you know what I mean. And I think that coupled with, you know, him doing this amazing jukebox jury appearance where he punched, you know, his hands in the air because he got every question right. We just thought, he's such fun. We've got to take this band on. And that's kind of in about, I guess that was 92. We took them on then. And then suddenly they released Babies and Razzmatazz. And, you know, they were on everyone's radar. And we organized the first Britpop feature with Pulp and Suede and the Auteurs, three of our bands, with the cover of Select magazine. That was the first Britpop feature, 93 possibly, can't remember exactly. And then, of course, after that, so much happened, which is what the book's about, really.
And so you picked them up after they'd been going for about 10 years, or more, in fact. Was it hard to generate interest for a band that had been going so long and hadn't really made it?
Yes, because the NME, I spoke to the NME and they said, why have you taken on Pulp? They've been going for more than 12 years. They're part of the furniture. And I think I said, because everybody in the office loves them. We go and see them live for all the time. They've suddenly become really good. Of course, Pulp would say that they'd always been really good, but something happened around, you know, My Legendary Girlfriend, where everything clicked, I think. And then there was a series of those three singles that I just mentioned that made them get to a point where, you know, for instance, they could stand in for the Stone Roses when the Stone Roses pulled out of Glastonbury and headline it. And I literally thought they were going to be bottled off because they were an office secret. But obviously everybody loved them. And I didn't realize that at that point. And obviously they had two number two singles with them, Babies and Sorted for Reason Whiz, one of which was kept off the top spot by Robson and Jerome, I think. But you know, they got to a point where they became quite massive. They were, as I like to describe them, a 15-year-old overnight success story.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but you said a couple of times here that they had this massive leap, if you like, in songwriting standards. Can you attribute that to anything? Is there anything you can point at and say, well, this is the reason why they suddenly got good?
Well, I think part of it was Jarvis fell out of a window or off a window ledge in, I think it was probably in the late 80s. And that kind of persuaded him that, you know, that he was just dreaming of this universe that he was actually all around him. You know, I think being in a wheelchair for a year persuaded him that he had to write about what was around him. And in doing that, I think he suddenly hit on the jackpot. You know, he hit about, you know, when all the songs became very microscopic in detail, the way he was describing the relationships he was observing, because he was never grown up enough to have one himself. I think that was a big inciting incident in the change in Pulp songwriting.
And, you know, they took off, and that was around the time that they joined you. So basically, it was all down to you, right?
It was not. Well, okay, I would say that Suede we made Suede so big that it helped every other band on our roster, and that's a good thing. But Pulp were slightly older than everybody else, so they looked at it kind of through what wizened eyes. I think, you know, they didn't really take anything seriously that was going on in the country at the time, but, you know, Britpop wise, as it were, and that was a very, very good move for them. But obviously, there came a point when, I mean, you know, if we want to talk about, you know, where this book came from, and obviously the fact that people think this is hardcore was a difficult album for them, and I wanted to write about why it was a difficult album, and the reason for that was the Michael Jackson incident on February the 19th, 96 at the Brit Awards, because that was the moment that sent Jarvis into this orbit of fame that he just could not handle, and he became the fifth most famous man in Britain. I think he was time behind Frank Bruno, Michael Barrymore, John Major, and believe it or not, Will Carling, who was having an affair with Princess Di at the time.
I believe all of that. Now, I wanted to talk about the Brit Awards after this next song, if that's okay with you. And then we'll move on to the book. You had Marion. I'm going to play Marion. Let's All Go Together.
Oh,
you had Marion on your roster. Tell us something about Marion.
I loved that band. I could never understand why they weren't massive. I mean, I really, really thought they were special. I think I saw them in a small club in London and met their manager, Joe Moss, who I think used to work with the Smiths. And they really had something. They had a little heart, that band. I'm still in touch with Jamie, and I think their first few singles were phenomenal. And so, I mean, as to if I could tell you an anecdote, I can't think of an anecdote offhand apart from the fact they're just great people.
No, they were. Their debut album, I mean, Let's All Go Together, for me, is one of the songs of university for me. I'm going to play that now, and then after that, we'll talk about the Brit Awards, and then I promise you we will talk about the book, and in particular, This Is Hardcore. This is Marion, Let's All Go Together. Jane, it was the Brit Awards at the weekend. Did you watch them?
No, I've heard all about them. I didn't go. I went to several in the 90s, but I didn't watch them on Saturday Night. No, it seems like I know two members of Blur were there, but it seems like a different world for me now.
Yeah, well, I agree. I don't think many people of my generation bother watching it. There's somebody who won a load of a record number of Brit Awards who I've never actually heard of. So that tells that tells you where we are on that. But can you tell us what you know about the Jarvis Michael Jackson incident?
Okay, so the Michael Jackson incident, as I like to call it, which occurred on February the 19th at the Brit Awards at Earl's Court, happened because Michael Jackson was kind of performing his version of Earth Song, and Jarvis got incensed. He was sitting in the front row, and because Michael Jackson surrounded himself with prepubescent children, and it was kind of about a few months after he'd settled out of court for the Jordan Chandler sort of case. And I think it felt like Jackson was trying to exonerate himself from, you know, all the accusations that were floating around at the time. So Candida kind of egged him on to get on stage. And she said, "You'll never do it." And of course, he jumped up on stage. And I like to describe it that he waggled his fully clothed bum at Michael Jackson, because people, when they look at it now, it looks really innocent. He's got all his clothes on. He just basically wafts with his hand behind his bum. It's not even a successful mooning incident. But he got arrested and then taken to the dressing, or rather, he was asked to go to the dressing room where he was arrested. And then on the night, Bob Mortimer is in the attendance, and Bob Mortimer was a QC, actually. And Bob Mortimer worked for Peckham Council as a legal counsel. He represented Jarvis on the night, and when I think he recalls going into the cell and said, "What have you done?" And and Jarvis saying, I waggled my bottom at Michael. that was the conversation. And then Jarvis was obviously let out, you know, on bail, with the possibility of being rearrested and charged. But then David Bowie, who'd been actually awarded a special award on the night, he had a team of cameramen there, and they showed that Jarvis, because Jarvis was accused of knocking children off the stage, which of course was not true at all. It was one of the bouncers that did that. So David Bowie gave his footage to the police, and Jarvis was immediately released, which I think Jarvis says was one of the many things he's grateful for David Bowie for doing. So obviously Jarvis got off from that, but became instantly infamous overnight, so much so that the police would often stop him in the street and he'd expect to be arrested, and they'd ask for his autograph. And I think that sent him into a fame orbit which he just couldn't handle. And I've used that as the year zero for my new book. That was the reason that they ended up writing a record like This Is Hardcore.
And so how was that from a PR perspective? Was it a nightmare or was it gold dust?
It was a nightmare for 24 hours until everybody woke up and realised, because there was a rumour that one of Jackson's lawyers had actually said, "This is your chance, Michael. We've got this strange British guy who's knocked children off the stage while you're trying to save them. This is your chance, you know, to exonerate yourself with the public." And so I think all the tabloids believed that line for 24 hours. And then they thought, hang on a second, that's not quite right, is it? You know, Jarvis is just like this innocent little chap from Sheffield. And he had the best of intentions. And there's something more sinister going on here. So Jarvis became a kind of, within a couple of days, Jarvis became more of a hero than a villain. So it was quite difficult to manage for that first 24 hours. And after that, it was just managing the fact that everybody wanted to speak to him, and there were calls for him to be knighted and all this kind of weird stuff. But either way, it was very difficult for Jarvis to continue writing songs about being, you know, about wanting and yearning for something when he'd obviously achieved something that he'd been yearning for, except I described it as the wrong kind of fame.
But you couldn't, I mean, you talk about how sometimes back in the day you would make up a few stories just to make it sound good. You really couldn't make this up. You've got Michael Jackson, you've got Jarvis Cocker, you've got David Bowie, you've got Bob Mortimer acting as a lawyer. If you made that up, people would say, come on, let's be serious here.
No, funny enough, today, Rolling Stone published an extract from my book, and so I put it on my Insta, and so a couple of people sort of said that Bob Mortimer story is great if it's true, because because obviously it's very difficult to believe, isn't it? You know, I mean, all the surrounding paraphernalia that was around going around that story at the time, it was completely crazy. I mean, ultimately, or certainly by the end of the year, it had made Jarvis become on the edge of a nervous breakdown. He'd absconded to New York and stayed under a pseudonym in the Paramount Hotel because he wanted to get away from it all. So, you know, and it was something that he'd just done on a spur of the moment. It was completely unplanned, and it did this thing to his career.
And The Guardian, I think I read this in your book, that The Guardian calculated that there was £750,000 worth of free advertising and an extra 50,000 records sold just off the back of it.
Yes, and obviously they'd only performed sort of Reason Whiz on the night. There was no big pulp brouhaha from their performance. It was just from Jarvis waggling his fully clothed bum, as they say. And they did publish that stuff. I think Jarvis would have preferred to sell less records and keep his dignity. And you know, it did help sales. You're right.
Yeah. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to play This Is Hardcore to get everybody in the mood, and then we're going to talk about your brand new book called This Is Hardcore. So gather your thoughts. I'm sure you have plenty of them, and we're going to talk about your book immediately after this. This Is Hardcore.
Hits from the 1990s.
Ready now, I'm seeing all the things.
This is Hardcore by Pulp, and we have in the studio this week Jane Savage, who is releasing a book on Thursday called This Is Hardcore. What's it about, Jane?
Well, I think the fact that song is so long makes my point, really. But the book is really about the record that destroyed Britpop, because it was Jarvis's way of destroying his own fame and career. And on it, obviously, the subject of pornography dominates the record, you know, with the artwork and the imagery and the songs, etc. And I think it was, I mean, I describe it as a bit like Reggie Perrin's Grot Shops, you know, where even though the music is amazing, I think it was intended to destroy their career. And it inadvertently ended up ending Britpop, because it was obviously so far removed from different class and common people. So the book is a microscopic sort of examination of why the record came about, starting with the Michael Jackson incident in February 96, and everything that led up to the recording of the record, and the way that Russell left the band because he hated Help the Aged, and then obviously Jarvis decamping to New York and coming back, and then recording, you know, going to see his dad in Australia, and all the songs having such depth to them, and you know, releasing a song called, obviously, Help the Aged, which was about dying and old people and getting it into the top 10. And the record really is about, Jarvis equates fame with pornography or hardcore pornography. And I think because you get examined in great detail, I think it's a brilliant record to analyse. And that's why I wanted to write the book.
And I always find that a bit unfair on bands, that they release a really successful album, and then people expect them, if Pulp had released another Different Class, like Different Class Mark II, they would have said, well, it's just the same as Different Class, you know, it's brilliant songs, but it's just the same. They haven't developed, and then they do develop and they do something different, and they say, well, it's not as good as what they did before. Well, it's very difficult to replicate.
Well, I guess you could go back to 94 and look at Dogman Star, which is possibly their magnum opus, which was, you know, a very weird record indeed. You know, there's a lot of weird stuff going on in Brett's life at the point that they made that record. And Dogman Star and This Is Hardcore are two sides of the same coin, I think, really. And This Is Hardcore is a very deep record, but people weren't expecting or wanting it. They did want Common People, Different Class, Mark II. And but for me, this record gives much more, you know, as you listen to it. I mean, I obviously had to listen to it many, many times again to write this book. And it's fascinating, you know, and what's going on in the record and the reference points, the fact that I'm the Man, that song is about toxic masculinity and the Loaded Generation and the Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels era of the 90s, which no one was really writing about at the time. And obviously Britpop became this laddie thing that was nothing to do with Suede and Pulp, even Blur, who started it. It became this football thing, which I don't think was anything to do with Britpop from the beginning.
Did you think that was because of Oasis?
Yeah, I described that as bigger boys came. Or rather, when everyone used to go to a club called Syndrome, just off Oxford Street, and, you know, to some extent, all the other clubs that were around at the time, you'd find Catherine Moran and journalists like Sean Patterson sort of dancing around with Jarvis and members of Suede and Elastica and Menswear. We used to, you know, live in houses together. And then a kind of Oasis came, and it was the first time I noticed bouncers being around and roped off areas, and it just felt not as cozy. And I guess it made it a global thing, but it also made it kind of charged with something that I didn't particularly like. And I think that's what some people have a problem, you know, about from that era.
And is there a band that you think, looking back, I wish I'd done PR for them?
Yeah, the two bands that I really would have loved to do PR for from the 90s were Teenage Fan Club, because they were with Creation, and Creation never paid for anybody out of house to do PR, and the Manic Street Preachers, because they were so my band. I mean, I loved everything about them. You know, I met them a few times in the 90s, and I loved Richie to death. And I think, I mean, obviously they're touring now with Suede this year, so I can't wait to go to that. But I think they're the two bands I would have loved to have done in the 90s.
And so we're getting towards the end of the show. Of course, your book is out on Thursday, and I checked it out, and you can order it on Amazon now, and it will be here just in time for the weekend. So any listeners now, if you're listening right now, get on Amazon and make sure you get Jane's book. I've been lucky enough to have a sneak preview of it, and it's definitely worth buying. And it's straight into paperback, which I think is a great thing, because, you know, who wants to bother with a hardback nowadays? But the last song we're going to play is The Fear. Is there anything you'd like to say about that song?
Well, The Fear set the record up, really. It's about having a panic attack, obviously, and the first few lines of it make you know what the record's going to be like. I've actually got this strange section in the book where I pretend to go to HMV in Oxford Street and take the record back, because I don't think it's a pulp record, because they made a mistake. They put the wrong vinyl into the, you know, it's kind of one of these magical realist bits that I like to do. And then, of course, they start playing it in the shop and everyone's freaking out. And then I realise, oh, I think I might have read something about them, you know, doing a song like this. And I realise, and I say, can I have my pulp record back, please? So I think it's that kind of song. It's so strange.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so Jane, your album, This Is Hardcore, sorry, your book, This Is Hardcore, is out on Thursday, available on Amazon to order. Jane, thank you so much for joining us. Jane, of course, has done two other books as well. So if you're interested in that, let us know. Otherwise, this is The Fear by Pulp. Thank you for listening. See you on the flip side.
Taking you back to the 90s.
Baby, here comes the feeling again. Oh, The Brit Pop Show.